Dreyfus knew better than to argue. I suppose there's always a chance the dead will give us something.
You do have a way with them,
Aumanier said. Vanessa Lahr just notified me, by the way. Our sequestration order came through. We have Antal Bronner's beta level. See if you can get something useful from the poor man, will you? Dreyfus made to rise. Have you ever had to tell someone that they're dead?
No,
Aumanier said. I prefer to leave that sort of thing to the experts. Sparva was eating alone at one of the corner tables. He seemed hunched over his tray, as if pressed down by the low, curving ceiling. Talia set her own tray down without begging an invitation. For a moment she let her friend get on with his meal, using the special cutlery that had been provided for hyperpigs. He ate fastidiously, taking small mouthfuls and chewing carefully. He had even tucked a napkin into his collar. His reading spectacles were set on the table before him, next to a compad.
"I hear you're doing well with the polling cause," he said. "Not exactly thrilling work, it's got to be said, but they wouldn't trust it to anyone but a safe pair of hands."
"How long was that thing in my cutter?"
Sparva's cutlery clinked. "Dreyfus will keep you on it for a little while longer, but that's only because he knows you'll do a thorough job." He carried on eating, nodding between mouthfuls.
"This is actually not too terrible. You should try it.
Or maybe it wouldn't suit a baseline palate with your restricted range of taste receptors." He looked at her with vague, sympathetic interest.
"How do you live like that?"
"It was pure luck that I was near that man, wasn't it?" She pressed closer, lowering her voice.
"I've been thinking about that, and what Aumanier said.
I should cook for you again one of these days, show you what food's meant to taste like. Pork's off the menu, obviously, but other than that..."
"So they must have hundreds of those boxes, stashed aboard our ships, just waiting for one of us to be in the right position."
Sparva dabbed at his mouth with the napkin.
"Did you hear the news about the boss man? Took it upon himself to pay a visit to Devon Garlin."
He tapped his spectacles against the compound.
"Lady Jane's spitting nails."
Talia's hands were now fists to either side of her tray.
"You have seniority over me, I understand. There are things you can talk about, and things you can't. Ordinarily, I'd respect that. But not after you talked me through cutting a man's head off while he was still alive."
Sparva took another mouthful, chewing and swallowing before giving his answer.
"He wasn't still alive. He was moving."
She leaned in closer still, her voice a hoarse whisper.
"He was still alive. You made me kill a man who was still alive. Did you listen to a word Lady Jane said about not saying anything more about this? She was talking about security leaks. You don't count. Now tell me about that man."
Sparva set down his cutlery, dabbed at his chin, then looked at Talia with his small, sad, all too human eyes. "By the time you got to him, the entire medical resources of the glit-abandoned Chasm City couldn't have made a difference. What mattered was getting some fragment of evidence back to Panoply." She was silent for a few moments. She leaned back, getting out of his face. The food on her tray was still untouched.
"Are you just going to leave it at that?"
"I'm sure you'll get a proper briefing at some point, but I won't be the one giving it. It's not that I don't trust you."
"Someone doesn't," she said sharply. "I suppose I shouldn't be too surprised. They can say they've exonerated someone, but whether they really mean it, deep down."
"You think this is about your father?"
He glanced down at his meal, what remained of it, then reached for his spectacles and stood to leave.
"It's about seniority, that's all. You were given a difficult duty to perform, and you did it. Be content with that."
They regarded each other for an uncomfortable moment. Deep down, she knew she was being unreasonable, pressuring him into a disclosure he had no right to give. But he was not the one who had gone through that nightmare in the Shiga Mintz spindle. She had done her duty all right, not disgraced herself. But Sparva wasn't the one who had vomited up his guts as soon as he was back on the ship, nor woken himself screaming as soon as he managed to sleep after his shift.
"He wasn't the first, was he?"
she said, knowing there would be neither confirmation nor denial from her friend.
Not by a long stretch. Not the first, and I'm guessing he won't be the last.
Aumônier admitted I'd brushed against something outside my clearance. Something big.
What is it, Spava? What are we dealing with?
I can't tell you.
Just give me a word. A case code name. Something.
Spava said nothing. Dreyfus's shoes crunched on gravel. The sound was sufficient to break the reverie of a lone man sitting on a park bench, staring into the grey distance. Irritation and confusion clouded his features, as if he had just realized that he had no recollection of arriving at the bench. The man started. Dreyfus raised a calming hand, softening his expression in a way that he hoped conveyed empathy and understanding. It's all right, Anton. You're among friends, and nothing bad will happen to you. Stopping before the man, he lowered down onto his haunches, bringing his eyeline level with the seated figure.
Who are you?
My name's Dreyfus. I'm a prefect. Something happened, and now you're in the care of Panoply.
How?
The man began, frowning.
What do you mean? Something happened?
Dreyfus put on a solemn look.
You died.
He paused, letting that sink in for a second or two. It was violent and irrevocable, with no prospect of neural consolidation. But you had a beta-level instantiation, shadowing you for many years. That beta-level has now been legally sequestered and brought to a responsive state within a simulated environment, executing inside Panoply. Dreyfus could have scripted the exchange that would follow.
No,
you've made an error. I'm definitely not dead. I'd know if I were dead. Do you remember walking to this bench? Do you even have an idea where we are now?
A habitat? Somewhere?
You don't remember because there was no transitional experience. Under the terms of the sequestration order, you were placed in immediate executive quarantine. You are the only copy of Anton Bronner presently executing. You were re-initiated a few seconds before I arrived.
No, the beta level said flatly. There's been a mistake.
I wish there had been, Anton. But look at it this way. The whole point of you was to shine, now. To speak for Anton Bronner when Anton could not. Maybe some part of that got through. Though denial was a virtually universal reaction, the beta levels varied starkly in the way they moved from denial to acceptance. The ease or otherwise of that shift was unavoidably correlated with their base personality.
I don't feel dead,
the beta level said, more flatly than before. He stared down at his own sleeve, as if some desolate truth lay evident in the fabric's weave.
You didn't feel dead when you were alive,
so you won't feel it now. The crucial thing is that you may be able to help us.
How can I possibly help?
We need to talk about how you died.
You said it was violent. Was I murdered?
It was a medical event, and an extreme one. Dreyfus paused, his knees beginning to ache. He was squatting for real in the grey box of the immersion room, with plugs jammed into his ears and goggles chafing at his skin. Whether it was deliberate or not, we can't say yet. Anton Bronner looked around, taking in the tall hedges and the distant arc of patterned landscape rising overhead, towns and hamlets laid across it like arrangements of tiny gaming pieces.
Will I be able to leave?
Dreyfus smiled tightly.
In good time. I want to speak to my wife. Giselin does know, doesn't she?
Your wife's been informed of your death, and she has constables and counselors to turn to. But I can't allow any possibility of evidential contamination at this stage of the investigation.
What evidence are we talking about?
You, Dreyfus said bluntly. At last, the effort of squatting had become too much. He beckoned to the seat and waited for a nod from Bronner, inviting him to sit down. Dreyfus settled his weight onto what he trusted would be a functionally equivalent surface, conjured out of quick matter in the interview room. For reasons presently unknown, something went wrong with your neural machinery. Your implants sent out debilitating signals, putting you into a grand mal seizure. Then they underwent a catastrophic thermal overload.
What does that mean?
A heat pulse, which boiled the surrounding brain tissue. They were facing the same way now, staring out across the lawn, a silvery fog creeping its way down the distant curve of the habitat's inner surface.
"We got to you as quickly as we could," said Dreyfus. "Had we been there a little sooner, we might have been able to slow down the thermal event. I'm waiting for our medical examiner to see if you can teach us anything we didn't already know. In the meantime, though, I'm counting on there being something, some detail or circumstance that might help."
Bronner gave a hollow laugh.
"There's nothing. I'd remember if there was."
"Has anything ever gone wrong with your implants?"
"Nothing."
"And you've had them all your life?"
"I don't know exactly when they were put in. Allowed to grow, I should say. I was just a boy."
"But since then?" "No complications?"
"None." "What happened to me, Prefect?"
Dreyfus kept his tone studiedly neutral. "Witnesses and public records place you walking through the park when you collapsed. There was no visible cause and no one else was affected. But something made it happen, and I'd like to know what. If there's anything in your past that you think might have any bearing..."
Bronner turned to face him. "Like what, exactly?
Some borderline procedure? Black market medicine? Illicit neural modification? Contract with ultras or conjoiners? You name it. Be as frank as you like, Antal. The last thing I'm going to do is prosecute you."
"I've never gone in for anything like that.
I'm not one for taking chances. I live in the Shiga Mint Spindle, for pity's sake." "I have to ask."
"Why do you?"
"I died. It's a tragedy for me, that's for sure. But it's not the sort of thing I'd expect Panoply to expend much energy on. Aren't you supposed to be making sure none of us commit voting fraud?"
"There's that," Dreyfus said, nodding slightly. "But it's not the limit of our remit."
With a grunt of effort, he pushed himself up from the bench, or rather its counterpart in the interview room. "If I've judged you right, Antal, you've told me the truth about yourself, to the limit of your knowledge.
I can see I've been a disappointment."
"Not at all. We're just getting started. This place, by the way, this simulation, we call it Necropolis.
And that's supposed to help me?"
Dreyfus gestured across the lawn, where the graveled path cut through a slot in the manicured hedge. "Follow the path. Look for an ornamental garden, a big lake, some terraces and pavilions. Sooner or later you'll bump into some other people. They all know each other by now, and they all know why they're here." Some dark realization shadowed Bronner's eyes.
"The same thing happened to them, didn't it?"
The briefing was short, because Dr. Demikov had already told them almost everything of significance. Sparva sat through it, toying with his spectacles as the neural scans and slices played across the tactical room's walls, projected over dark, varnished wood. Bronner's implants, what had been salvaged of them, resembled the mangled, blackened remains of space vehicles after a bad re-entry. Dreyfus had not been present during the first conversation with the medical chief, but nothing Demikov said seemed to surprise him. He just sat there, nodding sometimes, rarely bothering with a direct question. Gaston Clearmountain and Lillian Beaudry listened stoically, offering the occasional clipped interjection. Jane O'Monnier said less than anyone, waiting until Demikov was finished, out of the room and back to some other pressing business.
"If I'm going to draw a crumb of encouragement out of this whole unpleasantness, it's that the protocol worked. The whiphound performed flawlessly, as did the cryogenic vessel."
"The only weak link," Gaston Clearmountain said, "was the prefect. Why did Eng take so damned long to reach him? She was already in the habitat."
"She had to go back for the equipment," Dreyfus said, mumbling out the words like a man on the edge of sleep.
"And whose bright idea was that?" Clearmountain asked.
"Yours,"
said the brittle, stiff-backed Lillian Beaudry, with a surprising lack of rancour.
"You didn't want routine activities hampered by prefects carrying around surplus equipment."
Clearmountain gruffed out his disgruntlement.
"She should still have been faster."
"Ground wings, you mean?" Dreyfus speculated. I was with her on the link the whole time, Sparva put in, before his boss inflamed an already tense discussion. Ng was the best prefect we could have hoped to have on hand. Whatever we learn from this episode, Omanier said, we're still left with essentially the same set of questions we had a couple of days ago. Tom, you've talked to the Beta? Do you see any scope for progress? Same story as the rest, Dreyfus said after a moment's reflection, surprised to be dead. Nothing in his declared background to explain the neural anomalies. I've already allowed him free interaction with the other Betas. Wise, Dreyfus? Asked Clear Mountain. They're dead, Dreyfus said. The least we can do is give them someone to talk to. Besides, we haven't time to do things by the usual routine. The collective gaze had shifted to the solid orrery. The 10,000 habitats were 10,000 tiny points of coloured light, glinting in shades of ruby, gold, emerald or topaz, each accorded a brightness in relation to the size of structure or population load it represented. Eight of the habitats had been enlarged and elevated above the true orbital plane of the glitter band, so that their true shapes were apparent. These were the eight breakaway states, technically no longer within Panoply's purview, but still a matter for consideration as far as Omanier was concerned. Then there were the others. 54 additional habitats, raised even further from the plane than the breakaway states. This had nothing to do with their physical locations in the glitter band, but everything to do with their recent significance to Panoply. There was, as yet, no overlap between the two sets of habitats. Of these, however, the 54th bore the characteristic shape of the Shiga Mint's spindle. Tom's right, Omanier said, her level tone drawing a line under any criticism of Dreyfus's methods. The Betas have a vested interest in helping us explain their deaths. The more they interact, the greater the chance that some common factor will come to light. It's a slim hope, but the best we have. Until the next death, Dreyfus said. Case 55. Omanier gave a slow nod. Fortunately, or not, depending on your point of view, I doubt we'll have long to wait. They were walking side by side, following the trail that skirted the biggest lake in this part of Necropolis. The woman next to Dreyfus was small and wiry with an acrobat's muscle tone. Her hair was trimmed to a functional crop, emphasizing the elfin structure of her facial bones. She wore a grey outfit of trousers and tunic, stitched with an interlocking design of white trees.
"It's not that I don't like your company," she was saying, "but I'm starting to feel as if we've already been over this 100 times.
"We probably have," Dreyfus said, walking with his head down and his hands behind his back.
"Then the point of these little chats is..."
"Maybe all it will take is the 101st interview. You'll let something slip, and that will give me the breakthrough."
"Let something slip,"
she repeated, mimicking his tone.
"As if I'm deliberately withholding something."
"I didn't mean it that way."
"Let me get something straight in my mind. I'm a digital artifact, a pattern of algorithms designed to emulate the responses of the living instantiation of me."
"They don't usually put it so bluntly, but yes. That's about it."
"And you've got me sequestered. You've moved a copy of my digital code into your machines inside Panoply."
"Not just moved, but put a legal and binding embargo on the continued execution of any remaining copies of you beyond Panoply. We only want to deal with one copy of you, and it's simpler for you if there are no conflicts when we release you back into the world."
"Whatever works for you. But one thing's clear enough to me. You already have the means to pick me apart, to examine my coding structure, my decision branch algorithms, my life logs. You can see through my soul like it's made of glass.
So why the time-consuming charade of these interviews?
Can't you just know everything there is to know about me?"
"Let me explain how that would work," Dreyfus said. "Only another artificial intelligence would be able to pick through your digital structure and hold all the details of your life log in its memory. We have machines that can do that, it's true, but any machine would still have to break everything down into a form that I could assimilate, and I'd still have to phrase my queries as natural language expressions, in which case I'd end up having a conversation much like this one,
only with a whole unnecessary layer of mediation between me and you.
Hmm.
She made a face that told him she accepted his answer, but still found something unsatisfactory in it.
And do my thoughts come into it?
You're continuing to exist, and can interact with other beta levels. Isn't that better than being frozen in limbo?
This isn't living, Prefect Dreyfus. No matter what you might like to think,
you'll feel differently when we release you.
Why should I? It'll still be just another pale imitation of life.
Only if you want it to be. Beta levels can still serve a social function.
Serve a social function?
She echoed.
How thrilling you make it seem. The afterlife is public servitude. I could water some flowers, tend some grass. Is that what you mean?
I wish there was something I could say to make it seem better. She had been the first of the dead to come to Panoply's attention, and her beta level the first to be sequestered. Dozens more had followed in the ensuing months, but she would always be the first victim, emblematic of those to come. He still remembered the false optimism of the early days, the slowly waning hope that some common link would be found among the cases. Whatever it was, though, it had not come to light through routine interviewing. Even the search turbines, programmed to probe into the fine-grained details of a life, had found nothing of significance. So why did he keep coming back to Cassandra Leng? Because he liked her, he supposed. Her bluntness, her unsentimental acceptance of death. Some of the other betas wanted things from him. Information, promises, changes to their terms of sequestration. Cassandra Leng seemed not to care about any of that. And in her directness, he believed he was getting as close to a truthful account of her beliefs and opinions as with any of the other dead. Something else, too, and with it, a prickle of distant guilt. Her directness reminded him of his wife. "I'm not really buying this cynicism, Cassandra," Dreyfus said. "Your living instantiation must have believed there was some worth to a beta level, or you wouldn't have gone to the trouble of having the emulation created."
"I did it for the living, not for myself. The way you make out a will so that people around you will be happier, to make them feel better, not for your own benefit."
"Is that really all there was to it?"
From the lakeside, they had a good view of the terrain as it swooped up beyond the gardens, rolling up into a tube. Lakes and hamlets glimmered in a haze of silvery distance. A small island rose from the lake, with a skeletal tower jutting into the fog.
"We may as well face it, Dreyfus," she said,
letting out a quiet sigh.
"I'm dead and gone. I died after taking a reckless gamble with my own life."
"It wasn't the risk-taking that killed you. It was just where you happened to be when the neural overload took place. The 112-year-old Leng had perished during a high-risk sport, an elaborate and dangerous cross between firewalking and tag, played out in the bowels of the Colfax Orb, a habitat that made a living for itself by courting hedonists, thrill-seekers, and the borderline suicidal. But what were you hoping to get out of that place to begin with?
Shall I let you in on a dirty little secret, Dreyfus?"
"If you like."
"Utopia is stifling. What's the point in longevity if every day is a great duplicate of the one before?"
"Life is still precious," Dreyfus said. "Still worth cherishing, no matter how it looks most of the time."
"I don't disagree. But you either live on the limits, or you're not living. I knew that, and I accept the consequences."
"You'd see yourself as a risk-taker, then?"
She glanced at him, rolling her eyes.
"Oh, this old hobby horse of yours. We've been over this, remember?"
"I still think there's something to it."
"You're entitled to your theories, Prefect, and I'll humour them while I'm here. Ask around, share stories, trade memories, as I've been doing for months and months already."
They walked a little further. By some degrees, the mist had lifted from the lake, and now the central island was more visible than it had been only a few moments earlier. The skeletal tower was actually a pylon, supporting the thin thread of a monorail line, swooping overhead and out across the lake.
"There's a new man, Antal Bronner. Have you spoken to him?"
"He's only just arrived, the poor confused soul. It would be a little cruel of me to inflict myself on him so soon after he came here, wouldn't it?"
"Not everyone shares your view of death."
"I'll talk to him for what it's worth. but I wouldn't get your hopes up. He looks boring to me. Not a risk-taker at all. She looked at him with something close to amusement. I think it may be time to find a new theory, Dreyfus, if that's the best you've got.
It is, he said, for now. Sparva knocked on the door, waited, knocked a second time. Half a minute passed, then Talia opened the door just enough to show her face. She was wearing off-duty clothes, her hair wet and glistening, as if she had just stepped through a wash wall.
What?
She asked, caught between irritation and interest. Come to give me a second dressing down for overstepping the mark?
Not exactly.
He didn't have to ask to be invited. They understood each other at least that well. Sparva waited until she had closed the door behind them, then moved to the low table in the middle of the room. He was about to conjure himself a chair when Talia saved him the effort and produced one to his usual specifications, which she knew by heart.
You want tea, I suppose?
No, I'm not sure I have the stomach for it. Sparva took the chair and bid Talia sit opposite him. She wore a black gown cinched at the waist, patterned with green gold dragons.
Something on your conscience?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I've been thinking everything over, especially in the light of our last conversation. The chair she had made for him was low, almost like something fashioned for a child, but there was no slight in that. She knew his tastes perfectly well, and he much preferred a chair that let him keep his feet on the floor, instead of having them swing in midair.
You were right, and I was wrong. You are involved in this, and you do deserve to know the fuller picture. But it's difficult, and this won't end well for me.
Then you'd better say nothing. There wasn't much charity in her tone.
No, I've made up my mind.
He looked her in the face.
Something bad is happening, Tal, and you've only seen a tiny part of it. We don't know what it is or where it's leading. Actually, that's not quite true. We know it's getting worse.
All right, she said, cradling the tea she must have prepared for herself before he arrived. Sparva picked up the smell of ginger, Talia taking her tea the way Dreyfus liked it. He wondered if she had adopted the habit out of preference, or because she wished to emulate or endear herself to Dreyfus. Whatever the explanation, he had no use for tea made that way. Ginger made him sneeze.
What is it? You asked about the case code name. It's Wildfire. People are dying, and we don't know why. That man you attended to, Antal Brunner, he's just the latest wildfire case, and there's no pattern that we can see. They're going through their lives, and then suddenly something goes wrong with their heads. A malfunction of the neural implants, leading to a thermal overload and massive distraction to surrounding brain tissue. That's why Demikov wanted that head frozen as quickly as possible, so he had some chance of working out what's going on, before the evidence cooked itself. But we weren't quick enough.
You mean I wasn't?
You did all you could. I vouched for you in that regard.
Oh, I need vouching for, do I?
They're on edge, the senior prefects. You can't blame them. This doesn't fit any patterns. It's not confined to one habitat. It's dispersed, emerging unpredictably. An asymmetric threat.
Talia sipped at her ginger-scented tea. I guessed that man wasn't the first. You wouldn't go to the trouble of preparing for something like that unless you'd already seen it before and were expecting new cases. She looked up from the tea, as if half fearful of the answer he was about to give.
Antal Brunner was the 54th that we're aware of. There's no clear link between them or where they happen.
How long has this been going on?
Sparva got up from the conjured chair. It's around 400 days since the first case, but that's as much as you need to hear from my lips. The rest you'd better hear from Lady Jane.
Why should she tell me any of it?
The damage has been done, Sparva said. You know too much to go back to checking cause now. She'll have two options, either wipe your memory or put you to work doing something useful. I know which I'd choose.
I hope you're right, Talia said. For both our sakes.
Chapter 3
The atmosphere in the tactical room was exactly as frosty as Talia had expected. Dreyfus had taken his customary seat to the right of Gaston Clear Mountain's chair, between Clear Mountain and a supernumerary analyst. Talia and Spava were sitting opposite Omanier. Spava's usual position on the other side of the table was vacant.
"We had higher hopes for you than this, Aang," said Lillian Beaudry,
raising her voice over the soft whispering of one of the analysts, who was briefing an internal prefect on the extreme left of the table.
"It's a shame to see them dashed."
"Aang committed no actual breach of rules," Omanier said. "She may have violated commonplace professional etiquette, but that's an entirely separate matter."
"Security was breached," said Ingvar Tench.
"The fault for which lies with Spava Bankol," Omanier said, directing her gaze slightly to Talia's left. "You knowingly violated a high-level directive. You were under express orders not to disclose the nature of this emergency to any operative below full field status."
"With respect," Spava began.
"I'm not done," Omanier said with fierce calm. "Grave damage has been done, Bankol. There's never been a higher need for secrecy. Panoply is already under pressure with the breakaway problem. Our hands are tied, and now we have this developing crisis to contend with. So far, we've been lucky. Extraordinarily so. How many is it now, Tang?" Robert Tang, the other internal prefect present beyond Ingvar Tench, glanced at his readouts. Tang was a small, fastidious man, known for his close attention to detail.
54 known deaths at present, Supreme Prefect."
54, she said. 54 dead, and no one, beyond us, has yet drawn a line between them. The instant this becomes public knowledge, we'll have a panic on our hands like nothing we've seen. And yet, here you are, treating secrets with the utmost disregard."
"Why would we have a panic, ma'am?"
Talia cut in, doing her best to take some of the heat off her friend.
"Speaking."
"I'm sorry, Supreme Prefect." Talia steeled herself before forging on. "But yesterday I was sawing a man's head off in a public place. Doesn't that entitle me to know a little about what's going on?"
"It entitles you to nothing,"
Omanier said.
"She shouldn't even be in this briefing," Beaudry muttered. "It's already above her clearance."
"That horse has bolted," Dreyfus said in a barely awake drawl. 10-1, she already knows the case code name. You may as well show her the wildfire curve."
"I don't think," Omanier began.
"She can be an asset to us," Dreyfus said, rousing himself a little. "But if she's to play her part, she needs to know all of it."
"I don't agree with this," Beaudry said.
"You don't have to," Dreyfus said. With a sigh, Omanier nodded at one of the analysts.
"The most recent projections, folding in the 54th death."
The analyst made a quick, deft conjuring gesture. A graph lit up on the wall, projected directly over the dark, varnished wood. A scattering of 54 dots were clustered around a bunch of curving lines, steepening from left to right. The lines were annotated with thickets of blurred symbols, but the more Talia squinted, the less they came into focus.
"Prefect Dreyfus says you have the mantle,"
Omanier said.
"Let's see it."
Talia looked at the graph a little longer.
"I can't read the annotation," she said.
"I presume that's something to do with security dyslexia. But I know an exponential curve when I see one. How far along the time axis are we?"
400 days, near enough," Dreyfus said.
"Are both axes linear?"
"Yes," Robert Tang said.
Talia nodded. "Then your curve looks to be reasonably well approximated by e to the power of x, where x is the number of days divided by 100. Let's see. You'll hit 100 cases around day 460, or barely 2 months from now, which sounds manageable. But you're on a doubling time of about 70 days, which means 1,000 cases about 290 days from now, and 2,000 only 70 days after that. I'm sure I'm oversimplifying it, but you've grasped the essentials,"
Omanier said. "Based on the present pattern, we lose the entire population of the Glitter Band in less than 4 years. Half the population would have succumbed only 70 days prior to that point. There'd be nothing resembling civilization left by then. Critical services, from security to life support management, would have long since collapsed. By some projections, the end point would be crossed when we lose one-tenth of the population in less than 3 years. Personally, I think that's optimistic. Panic would have set in long before that, and far beyond our means to control. We're a tiny dose of order in a body politic on the constant edge of chaos. But it won't come to that, will it? Talia asked, looking around those present. There are only 54 cases at the moment. There'll turn out to be something special about these people. Something that predisposes them to whatever this is. If there is, Beaudry said, we haven't found it yet. Close the graph, Omanier told the analyst, before returning her gaze to Talia. Prefect Dreyfus says you could be valuable to us, Eng. Fast, resourceful, and able to make connections. I'd like to help, ma'am, if I'm able. I'm minded to make the best of this regrettable situation. She continued giving Talia her long, level look. From this moment on, you'll be given probationary upgrade to Field 1, along with pangolin clearance and full access to all materials relating to wildfire. This is highly unorthodox, said Beaudry. Omanier smiled at the woman sitting to her right. Orthodox or not, Lillian, it's my decision. Tang and the analysts looked down at their work. Talia's mouth was dry. She felt obliged to say something. Thank you, ma'am. Don't thank me, Omanier said curtly. I'm about to make your life significantly less pleasant. She'll need a team, Dreyfus said. Omanier nodded. And normally I'd assign two deputies to any field working on a similarly difficult case. But in this instance, security considerations remain paramount. She'll have to make do with a single subordinate. Did you have anyone in mind? Talia was thinking of the up-and-coming deputy she had scouted in the refectory and training rooms. You'll be working with Bankal. I'm demoting him from Field Prefect 1 to Deputy Field 3, with immediate effect. Talia glanced at Spava, unsure what to say. Even a mouthed apology seemed insufficient. Consider it a temporary reduction in rank, Bankal, Omanier went on. As a disciplinary action, you'll report to Eng and assist her in the investigation. You may retain pangolin clearance. That's very generous of you, Spava said. Don't be flippant, Bankal. I expect your full and unswerving cooperation in this investigation. Is that understood? Spava lowered his head, the severity of her reprimand evidently getting through. It's understood, ma'am. I apologize for my error. Good. Please don't make a second one. I need you ready and able to move on the next death, whenever it happens. In the meantime, you can accompany Eng back to Shigamint's spindle. To interview the wife? Talia asked. Giddy at the sudden shift in her rank and responsibilities. A little more than that. A short while ago, Giselin Bronner issued a formal request for protection, over and above the security arrangements of the local constables. Then she knows something, Dreyfus said, a glimmer of hope cracking through his voice. Omanier sounded less hopeful. Whatever the case, it's not a request we can afford to ignore, but it has to be handled delicately. We don't want the constables sensing there's anything out of the ordinary, or feeling that their capabilities are in question. We're going to need them on our side in days to come, across the whole glitter band, and they mustn't feel undermined. I think I can handle it, ma'am, Talia said, with Spava's assistance, of course. You'd better, Omanier said. Then she turned to the small, neat Tang. Prepare a pangolin shot for Eng. She can take it immediately, so the structures embed as she sleeps. Enjoy your last good night's rest, Eng. When you open your eyes, you'll wake up to our world. Talia remembered how it had felt to hold a man's head. I'm already in it, ma'am, and I don't think I like it very much. Julius and Caleb were called back to the shell house in the middle of the morning. I know why. Julia said. It's Dr. Starsoff. It could be anything, Caleb said. No, Julia said. asserting himself before his larger, more confident twin.
"I know, it's him. After you'd gone off to the White Tree, I hung around in the house. The door to the private corridor was open, and I went down it."
"And?" Caleb asked.
"I saw Dr. Stasov. He was already here."
"If this is another one of your stupid stories, like the Ursas..."
"I saw him. I walked past the door, and there he was, lying on a bed. He was asleep, on his back, with his clothes on and that bag by the side of the bed."
"Asleep?
I wasn't going to wake him up, was I? I could hear Lurcher coming, and I didn't want to get caught. But I'm telling you, Spiderfingers is here. How could he be sleeping on a bed if he wasn't here?"
"You just saw some black clothes crumpled up."
"You'll believe me in a minute," Julia said. "Something's going to happen to us today. You'll see. Something to do with the machines he put in us last time."
The boys crossed the lawn and stood in front of the raised stone terrace which fronted the curved organic lines of the shell house. Their mother and father were already standing on the terrace. Father impassive, mother with that slightly anxious, doubtful look they had been seeing more of lately. Behind them waited Lurcher, a slender, tapering silver statue with its four hose-like arms drooping at its side. Beyond the house, through the green-tinted facets of the dome that enclosed their property, the spires and towers of Chasm City shone like a distant dream.
"The doctor isn't here,"
Caleb whispered.
"There he is,"
Julia said. Dr. Stasov came through the double doors that opened onto the terrace. He had his bag in one hand. It sagged so heavily it almost skirted the ground as he walked, throwing him off balance. Caleb gave Julius a look of grudging acknowledgement.
"Stand up straight, both of you," said Father. "Show Dr. Stasov how well you've been coming along."
Stasov brushed a swoop of white hair from his dark eyes. They were pink-rimmed, lacking focus.
"I used to have trouble telling them apart,"
Dr. Stasov said, his voice faltering.
"But not so much now. They're growing into distinct young men."
Even Julius had been aware of the growing differences between them. They had never been identical twins, but when they were smaller they had been easily mistaken for each other. Julius was lagging now, though. Caleb was taller and bulkier and broader across the shoulders and chest. Both had grey-blue eyes, but Caleb's were steelier, and there was something in the set of them that was already more challenging, echoed in the defiant, cocksure set of his jaw. They wore only shorts. Their knees were smudged. Their loose blonde hair was dishevelled. Until they were called back to the house by Lurcher, they had been scrambling up and down the huge hollow trunk of the White Tree, playing games among the mazy warren of its roots and branches.
"Growing too quickly," Father said. "A little less time horsing around in the garden. A bit more time in the classroom wouldn't hurt either of them."
"They're boys," said Mother.
"You have struck a healthy balance between education and development,"
Dr. Stasov said, giving a diplomatic nod to both parents. Where Dr. Stasov wore black, offset only by a puffed white collar, Mother and Father were dressed in the stiff finery of Chasm City's social elite.
"Do you think they're ready for it?" Father asked.
"I have no doubts, Mr. Voy."
"What about you, Julius and Caleb?" asked Father. "Do you think you're ready to learn something new?"
The boys answered in a trebly near unison.
"Yes, Father."
"Before we begin," Father said, "show Dr. Stasov how well you have adapted to the first integration. Clad yourselves. Make plumage."
Julius and Caleb glanced at each other, neither quite able to suppress a smile at the trivial nature of this challenge. They closed their eyes for a moment, more out of habit than necessity, signalling concentration. Then each lowered a hand down the length of their own body. Where their hands passed, patterns of colour and texture condensed out of the air, threads and cross-threads thickening into a widening band of fabric, which enclosed each boy in a kind of gown. When the gowns had reached just above their knees, the boys lifted their hands away and settled them by their sides, as if waiting inspection. Their gowns glittered in metallic shades, silver for the bigger boy, gold for the slightly smaller. A gentle breeze moved through the surroundings of the shell house, and the gowns rippled as if they were real.
"Impressive,"
Dr. Stasov said, his lips hardly moving as he spoke. Like the clothes he wore, He was made up of monochrome contrasts. His skin was an ashen white, his mouth a grey-rimmed hole, his eyes black tunnels. His hair was silver, combed low over his eyes. His fingers were long, bony, pale, and seemed to have one or two joints too many. "Their controls becoming more fluid, both of them," Father said. "It's rudimentary as plumage goes, but that will improve with practice."
"It had better," Mother said,
nodding to the dome wall, the glittering promise of the spires beyond.
"There's a city and a world out there that will expect more of you than parlour tricks. Your voice, now. With that name comes a burden of responsibility."
"They have time to learn," Father said, reaching into his pocket, a deep physical pocket in a physical garment, to draw out a thick, dark rod about as long as his forearm. He held it out before him with just the one hand, the tendons in his wrist taut as bridge tables.
"What is it?" Julius asked.
"Take it, and I'll explain." Still wearing his plumage, Julius stepped onto the edge of the terrace and took it in both hands. It was heavier than it looked. Caleb watched. "It's a malleable stuff," Father said. "A training device, made from solid quick matter."
"What am I supposed to do with it?" Julius asked,
conscious of Dr. Stasov peering at him through that curtain of hair, like a watcher behind a waterfall. "Quick matter will respond to gestural commands," Father said. "But that's a coarse, unsophisticated way of controlling it. Fine if you want to make a chair or open a pass wall, but you can do better than that. Your will alone is sufficient."
"I don't see how," Julia said.
Father smiled with strained patience. "Concentrate your attention on the malleable staff. Press your thoughts around it. Enclose it within them, and imagine the way it might stretch or bend under the pressure of those thoughts." He made an encouraging gesture. "Go on. See if you can make it flex a little." Julius stared at the staff, a frown notching its way into his forehead. He let go with his left hand, holding it near the end with the right, as his father had done, and tried to make it bend. But the staff felt dead and inert in his hand. His thoughts dashed off it like waves against a cliff. "Think only of the staff, and only of bending it," Father said, lowering his voice encouragingly. "Dr. Stasov has unlocked the capability in your neural machinery, but you must learn how to direct it." Julius stared and stared, but the staff remained obstinately unwilling to change itself.
"Why is it so hard?" he pleaded.
"It won't be when you've learned," Father said. "But quick matter won't respond to an ill-formed instruction or a passing whim. It would be far too dangerous if it did."
"You could do a horrible thing to someone," Caleb said wonderingly. "Chop them up or something. Squash them. You wouldn't want that to happen, would you, Julius?" "Shut up, Caleb," Julius said. "You're so clever, you make it bend."
He handed, jabbed, rather, the malleable staff into his brother's hand.
"I told you they weren't ready,"
their mother confided.
"We should ask Dr. Stasov to undo the permission. Give them more time."
"You know how awkward it is for the doctor to schedule these appointments," Father said.
"Julius might need more time," Caleb said. "I don't."
Holding the staff with more confidence than his brother, he stared at it for a few moments, narrowing his eyes but not closing them. The staff stayed as straight as when Father had given it to Julius.
"Could I really hurt someone?" Julius asked,
watching his brother's efforts.
"Or get hurt?"
"Not easily," Father said. "Quick matter knows not to do us harm. That's built into it at a very deep level. A kind of morality, like Lurcher's programming. That's why it won't change unless the intention is precisely directed. A skill both of you will have to learn the hard way."
"Progress, I believe," Dr. Stasov said.
The change was slight, to begin with, but it was real, and could only be the product of Caleb's shaping will. The staff was assuming a gradual curve, and the angle of the deflection was increasing. Caleb's hand shook with the effort of maintaining the neural focus, his eyes nearly crossing as he forced his desire onto the quick matter.
"Good. Very good," Father said.
"Better than I expected for a first try."
"'It's hard, Father,' Caleb said, the strain making him look older, finding the invisible weaknesses in his face that would eventually turn into folds and wrinkles. "'You've done very well. Give the staff back to your brother. Julius, see if you can straighten the staff. It's sometimes easier to restore something to an earlier state, if you have a clear idea of the desired end.' Julius took the bent staff and tried to undo Caleb's work. But the staff was as unresponsive as it had been before.
"'I can't,'
he said, offering the staff back. "'You tried, and that's all we expected for today,' Father said. "'I remember my first time. Your mother hers, don't you, dear?' Her answer was terse.
"'Of course.'
"'Days of frustration before the quick matter moved to our will,' Father went on. "'After that, though, I knew all the doors stood open, and the world was mine for the shaping. Here. He reached out for the staff. I'm a little out of practice. That's the price I pay for living here. But I still have the knack, I think. He made the staff straighten out. Then the end pinched itself into a knob, and the knob shaped itself into a tiny human head, with eyes and nose and mouth. For a few seconds, Father looked as if he was satisfied with that, before holding the staff up so the head was level with his view of their mother, and he began to shape the head's proportions and features to correspond to hers. Julius and Caleb looked on, their father's face set with quiet concentration. The quick matter moved like clay under an invisible hand, bulging, clefting, gaining lines and texture here, smoothing over there. Whether or not the end result was a close likeness to their mother was almost beside the point. It was certainly recognizable as a woman, and aspects of her strong nose and jaw were undeniably captured. Father twisted the staff around to show her the result.
"'You haven't lost your touch,'
she said, showing a cool indifference to the performance. Father pinched his lips, perhaps about to say something before thinking better of it, especially in the presence of Dr. Stasov. He passed the staff back to Caleb. "'See if you can undo my crude efforts,' he said, "'and both of you take an hour a day to learn to shape the staff.'
"'We'll try,'
Julius said. Caleb nodded.
"'Yes, we'll do our best.'
Then he patted Julius on the shoulder, his hand ghosting through the plumage.
"'Let's go back to the tree. We can take the staff out into the gardens, can't we?'
Dr. Stasov gave a nod, his hair curtaining down to his nose. "'No harm will come of it, but return to the house before mid-afternoon. I'd like to run some minor tests before I leave. The boy started walking away, Caleb swinging the staff low, so that his mother's head swished through the grass. It cost a slight but constant mental effort to maintain the plumage, so the boys gladly discarded their gowns when they were beyond the immediate sight of the house.
"'Give me the staff,' Julius said. "'I want to get better at it.' "'You couldn't do it at all. How can you get better at something you can't do?' "'You're not so good. You were straining so hard I thought your eyes were going to pop out.'
Caleb snorted.
"'I just put that on for the grown-ups. I sensed the presence of that quick matter staff long before they brought it out to show us. It's easy to say that now. I don't remember you going on about quick matter until you saw Spiderfingers was here. I knew it was in the house somewhere. I just didn't think it was worth mentioning. You could tell it was here, couldn't you?'
"'Yes,'
Julius said doubtfully, wondering how far he could push a lie.
"'I knew it was in the house somewhere. But you still found it hard. Not as hard as I made it seem. Look.'
With an easygoing nonchalance, Caleb passed the staff back to Julius. Julius held the staff up before him, looking at the little human head and trying to persuade it to undo itself, to collapse back into the smooth form of the original staff. Then he realized the face had changed. It was an ugly distortion of their mother's head, with demonic eyes and a wide, grinning mouth jammed full of sharp teeth. Julius started, the shock of it nearly making him drop the staff.
"'Don't worry, little brother,' Caleb said. "'You'll get the hang of it eventually.'
By the time Talia woke, the pangolin shot had worked its alchemy, modifying neural processing structures that allowed her to read and comprehend material that would normally have been above her classification grade. Pangolin, and the related security protocols, were the closest things prefects had to neural hardware. But the structures were deliberately self-dissipating, requiring continual booster shots to maintain their functionality.
Left to their own devices, the structures would break down under the action of normal body chemistry, their waste products harmlessly absorbed and excreted. She still woke feeling as if her brain had been through a mangle. The geometry of her apartment felt subtly askew, not quite a mirror of itself, but shifted, and each adjustment was pregnant with vast and ominous meaning. She had been warned about this. One of the side effects of pangolin was that ordinary visual structures acquired a heightened semantic weight. Prefects adjusted to it eventually, but the transitional phase could be akin to a religious mania, finding false significance in every wrinkle, every smear of foam in a mug of coffee. It was the price that had to be paid, though, and at least the security briefings on her compad were now fully legible. She skimmed the executive summaries over coffee and warm buttered bread, then stepped through a clothes wall, the wall forming her uniform around her to her customary preferences, then buckled on her belt and whiphound and set off for the docking bay, where she had been promised her own medium enforcement vehicle. For a moment, she stood at the observation window overlooking the dock. Her hands were tight and sweaty on the handrail below the window. She had been given the promotion she had always counted on, but she had never imagined it happening under these circumstances. And if Sparva's demotion was a temporary thing, so too, she was certain, was her elevation. "Do not mess this up," Talia said under her breath, calling her father's image to mind, "for both our sakes." Panoply's main docking and berthing facility was situated in what was nominally the nose of the pumpkin-faced asteroid. The freefall space was a three-dimensional jigsaw of launch racks, berthing cradles, and access tubes, with a frequent coming and going of vehicles passing through a huge double-doored spacelock. The chamber was not normally pressurized, though, so the spacelock doors were both open, with her assigned MEV already slid out onto its launch rack, aimed at the door like a chambered bullet. Talia dried her palms, walked into the pre-boarding area, and reported to the dock attendant, a man named Tyson. "Field Prefect Eng," she said crisply, without a smile. "Requisitioning Medium Enforcement Vehicle 17 for immediate deployment? I take it my ship's fueled and armed?"
"Gone up in the world, I see," Tyson said, his world-weary features conveying neither surprise nor interest in her recent promotion. "Your proficiency level just about clears you for the MEV. Don't mistake that for an expert rating."
"I wasn't about to."
"Your ride is ready for departure, Eng. See if you can bring it back without a dent.
Deputy Field Prefect Bankal should be here shortly," she said. "Send him aboard when he arrives."
"No need, Eng. Bankal's already aboard."
Talia maintained her composure as she made her way along the pressurized docking tube into the waiting ship and forward to the flight deck. Sparva, as she had been forewarned, was already seated in the right-hand pilot's position, an arc of control sweeping before him, displays and inputs already active. She regarded him for a few moments, hoping not to sour their new working relationship before it had started.
"You're keen," she said neutrally. "I felt I could use some familiarization time. I'm rated for MEVs, but it's at least a year since I've been in one."
"I also have the necessary rating."
Sparva twisted around to meet her eyes.
"Yes.
And who's your deputy now?"
"You are,"
she answered, with a nagging sense that she was being led into a verbal trap.
"That's correct.
And when Dreyfus had his hands on one of these, who did he generally ask to do the actual flying?"
"His deputy?"
"Which tended to be me. I assumed you'd accept the same arrangement, Tal. Operating one of these is mostly automatic, but you do have to keep an eye on things."
"And I couldn't?"
She was trying not to be baited, certain Sparva meant no ill by it, that he had genuinely been thinking of the arrangement that made the best use of her talents. But she had to draw a line now, or accept a slow, benign erosion of her status.
"I'm flying, Sparva."
Sparva gave a very human-like shrug.
"Of course. Absolutely not an issue. I just thought we'd do things Dreyfus's way, yes. And that's fine, most of the time."
She eased into the left-hand pilot's position, reaching out to assign the controls to her side, watching as some of the tactile interfaces reshaped themselves from hyperpig to human configuration. "But at the moment, until I say otherwise, we're doing things the Eng way."
"That's good,"
Sparva said. I like the Eng way. Vanessa Lauer looked up from her work as Dreyfus approached.